We are at the end of the road, right? Almost there. And we want to wrap up astrophysics. So you guys are now astrophysicists officially. You've finished the course. Well, I'm going to have to give your presentation on the 12th. Then you'll be officially astrophysicists. But we learned about a lot of different phenomena that happen in astrophysics. And if we didn't learn about the phenomena, we learned about the processes that underlie the phenomena. So you know the underlying physics, that in principle you can understand the process itself. It may take some time, but you can do it. So there, one thing I think I wanted to mention. There is this issue about the weak interaction that it was a bit unsettling. So remember, I talked about the decay of excited states. And we did it for a nuclear for a nucleus, and this was something like if it happens through emitting a photon, it went as alpha e, the decay rate went as alpha e times kr naught squared, where k is the wave number, r naught is the size, and then there's omega here. Right. So you see, this is first order in alpha. And the process, what was happening was you had an excited state, Zeta star, went to, I guess, what we call Y. This is incoming, but we went to Y. And in this case, it goes to a photon. So notice there is only one vertex here. And then this is linear in alpha. Now, so this is different for beta decay. So for beta decay, what you had was a neutron. Right, and it becomes a proton. And I told you the way that it happens is this is when we understand weak interaction, that it emits W minus in this case, because this proton is plus, W must be minus. And then it gives you the W minus decays to, so in this case, it would be an electron. Antineutrino. Good. Yeah. Why antineutrino?
You have to conserve lepton number.
You have to conserve lepton number. Right. So exactly. So W is not a lepton. It's the gauge boson. So it doesn't have a lepton number. So if you generate a lepton, you have to generate an anti-lepton. And the same is true here. So you conserve the baryon number as well. So what you notice here is that there are two vertices here, unlike here. So this is one thing I was puzzled, but I mean, it's obvious. If you just look at these diagrams, this just emits a photon, but then this guy, and this is true for atoms as well, when the excited atoms decay, is the same formula basically for the excited atom. But here, there are two vertices that involve. One is the one that you generate a W, and then the W decays to an electron antineutrino. And this has two, basically, powers. Instead of one power of alpha, this would have two power of alpha. So this gamma for beta decay, the way it works is something like, roughly speaking, it goes as some GW squared divided by mw squared. And am I doing this right? And then times mass of electron to the fifth power. So and this combination is called, so gw is analogous of electron charge, but for weak interactions. So remember, this one was So this would be this alpha. What was the definition of alpha? Does anybody remember? E squared over H bar C, right? So GW is analogous of E, but for weak interactions, since the weak interactions are weak, then this is this GW is smaller. So this is like alpha W squared, if you will. So you get a square of this because instead of one vertex here, you have two vertices. So it's like one higher order process. And it turns out that you get the 1 over mw squared, where mw is mass of the w particle. This combination is called the Fermi coupling constant, this combination. GF. And
does this assume that speed of light is equal to 1?
Yeah, here I'm setting a speed of light to 1, yeah. And okay, so the difference between this and this is that since there is only one vertex, there's one power of alpha. Here you have two powers, so this goes as alpha w to the fourth power. And the dependence on masses, that's a kinematic thing. So I'm not going to be able to derive it for you. But so it has to do, the mass of electron it's possible to do it, very straightforward way that I know of to describe. You just have to do the calculation here, and this is a Feynman diagram, basically. These are both called Feynman diagrams for this calculation. But I just wanted to explain for you what's the difference between this decay rate and this decay rate. And the difference is basically this is a higher order process because it involves two vertices here. It just involves one. That's why you get a higher power. Instead of alpha, you get alpha squared. And of course, for weak interaction, this is much smaller. GW is much smaller than alpha for electromagnetic interactions. And the other important thing is the whole thing is suppressed by this. So effectively, this MW, ME to the fifth divided by MW, is analogous of this factor that appears here. So they have to do basically with the size or effective wave number of whatever that exists in the middle. And this M is really a kinematic factor. Well, I guess it's similar. I mean, here you're producing omega. There's an odd power of this energy that comes in. And there's an odd power of this energy of electron that comes in. But these are, I mean, really different processes. And I think the only thing I just wanted to mention that would be useful to know is basically a process, the more of these vertices that it involves, the more powers of alpha you get. So that's something that's basic about quantum mechanics. And of course, depending on the process, so this is alpha. When it involves gamma, this is alpha electromagnetism. When it involves a W particle, this is a weak interaction that involves alpha of W. And just on dimensional grounds, you know, it should depend on some combination of masses, but exactly which combination of masses, you have to do the calculation to figure out what combination of mass.
Is alpha W G squared W over
NW
squared?
No, right. So alpha W is just GW squared. I mean, depending on how you define it, there could be a factor here, but roughly GW squared. But the thing is, the G Fermi is important because in the old days, you didn't know about the W particle. But the only way, you only get these combinations, right? So all your vertices had this combination. So you only had GW squared divided by MW squared. That was the G Fermi. So all the weak interactions, we didn't have this picture for them. We just had basically this picture for them. Now there are four particles involved. There could be different numbers coming in and out, but there is something that's just proportional to GF that sits at the center. Or I guess GF squared, I should say. Right. Okay, good. So that's, I guess, the last thing I wanted to say. Obviously, the fact is, if you want to do this properly, then you have to really do study particle physics and quantum field theory. And that's something that some of you might do, depending on exactly what topics you end up doing research on. Well, certainly think those of you who are here, you probably want to study quantum field theory and some particle physics. And particle physics is obviously very important in astrophysics and high-energy astrophysics. Okay, so we're just speaking of high-energy astrophysics, we started talking about it, and so I just said a bunch of more of a conventional, mentioned a bunch of things about what we think is what we call high-energy astrophysics, I should say. So these are basically, if you have energetic particles, more energetic than KeV, and then there are various places that they could be produced. And supernova explosions in larger scale, turbulence, and accretion disks, relativistic objects. So my plan for this last lecture is to talk about a very basic process in high-energy astrophysics called Fermi acceleration, which is how we believe most energetic particles in the universe, particularly charged particles, cosmic rays, are as energetic than they are. So let me, I guess I had a slide of that, but I can just, draw it for you. So this comes from, so this is an observation that we had since early 20th century, that if you can actually build detectors on the surface of Earth and detect very, very energetic particles. Detect very, very energetic particles that come from the direction of the sky. So cosmic rays, I don't quite know, remember the history, but it's early 20th century, I think 20s and 30s, they were detected. And of course, the question is, how can you get very energetic particles? So the energies that we're talking about is dN by dE versus energy. You start from energy of a proton, which is like say an electron volt. What is energy of a rest mass of a proton?
1 gigaelectron.
1 gigaelectron. So it starts from 10 to the 9. But then the largest energy that we observe is something around 10 to the 20 electron volt. 10 to the 21 even electron volt. And there is data. You could use different various observatories. This data, not all of this, you can collect it from the surface of Earth. But if you put everything together, there's something that's very close to a power law. So there's data points that go all the way. So they have error bars, all of them. So these are actual observations that cover this range. And this is roughly a power law that goes as roughly e to the minus 3. There's this kind of turns around mass of the proton, which is not surprising, because of course all your cosmic rays are the smallest ones are protons, and they become non-relativistic here. But then there seems to be a very, very nice, but almost the exact power law all the way in across almost 11 orders of magnitude in energy, right? It's 12 orders of magnitude in energy, basically. So then the question was, what causes these, basically, particles to be this energetic, given that, I mean, the most energetic things that we talked about so far in nuclear astrophysics, for example, they are MeV energies. So they don't go nearly as far as this. So this is the idea of Fermi acceleration. And the basic idea is that charged particles, they couple to the magnetic field, larger scale magnetic field, and larger scale magnetic field, as we've learned in magnetohydrodynamics, it moves with matter. So these cosmic rays would be kicked around by magnetic field, and they could basically gain arbitrarily large amount of energy through a scattering of so-called magnetic mirrors. What are magnetic mirrors? So the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about magnetic mirrors. But even before getting there, so the idea is that magnetic field because particles are restricted to them, kind of kicks their own particles. This is a cosmic ray. So if you say you have one mirror here, and you have another mirror here, oh, I guess the mirror would be here, but it's kicked around, right? Another mirror here, right? And if these mirrors are, say, moving towards each other, right? So what happens to the cosmic ray? Okay, right. What happens to its energy?
It's bigger.
It's bigger, right. Right, so I mean, you could think of it as if there was a photon, everything is bounces, it gets blue shifted because the mirrors are moving, right? And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So that's the basic idea of Fermi acceleration. But the idea is that the magnetic field plays a role of this mirror. And the thing is, of course, this doesn't happen indefinitely. These mirrors aren't perfect. In some sense, they have a finite reflection coefficient. So some cosmic rays stay between mirrors for a long amount of time. But then some of them, there's a probability for them that every time they actually escape this situation. So this obviously happens, doesn't happen everywhere. You need places where these mirrors are moving towards each other. And cosmic rays are trapped there for a while, but then escape. And you could show, and that's what we're going to do today, is we could show that at the end of the day, the cosmic rays that escape from this situation have a power law spectrum. Okay. So first, let's talk about the mirrors. What sense are magnetic fields mirrors? Good. So this is the basic idea. Is that clear, everybody? So magnetic mirrors. So what is a magnetic mirror? Does anybody know? Or a magnetic bottle is another thing that's related to it. Anybody heard about a magnetic mirror?
Heard of magnetic traps.
Okay, so what is a magnetic trap?
It's where you use a magnetic field to restrict the position.
Uh-huh. And how do you do it? What a structure of magnetic field can do it?
I'd say
so the idea is that magnetic field, if you have a magnetic field, then particles go around it, right? This is your charged particle. So,
you have a loop of field?
Okay, good. So that's one way to do it. If you have a loop, then you can. So those are called so-called tokamaks, right? So tokamaks, the way they work, and I guess that's one the idea that people are trying to build fusion reactors on Earth is to have curved magnetic fields like this. And then you could trap basically charged particles here and make them very, very hot and have nuclear fusion happen in those tokamaks. So that's one way to do it. Is there another way to trap charged particles? Okay, so this other one is not quite as obvious as this one. It's a little bit less straightforward. So to see that, let's just think about dynamics of this magnetic field as the charged particle as the magnetic field changes slowly. So what we know about the magnetic field is, of course, we know M. So this we know Newton's the second law. That momentum, P dot, rate of change of momentum, is E times V divided by C cross B. Okay? Right. So P dot is, let's imagine just T frequency. So this would be omega cross p, where omega is the angular frequency. The e v over c cross b. And if I'm just interested in momentum, so of course momentum in along this direction doesn't change because there is no force, that would be the only momentum perpendicular to the magnetic field. So omega times p perpendicular would be E, and let's say it's relativistic, ultra-relativistic, which would be the case for all of these cosmic rays, they're ultra-relativistic. So V is approximately C, so this would be 1. So omega is just P perpendicular times times B, okay? And if I want, I can write it in terms of gamma, right? Am I doing this right? So what I want, what else do I need? So P perpendicular is just, did I write this correctly? P perpendicular, do I need, I need a radius. I can get a radius if I want to. So this is P perpendicular. Now, the other, so I think I haven't made a mistake here, have I? P dot is omega cross omega. Right, so omega goes as 1 over energy of the particle because the P is at least the with some sine theta angle. So P per, if this is an angle, this is a pitch angle. Let's say this is theta. What do you call that theta? Yeah, so if I say this is theta, then this P perpendicular would be just P times cosine theta, right? And P is approximately basically energy. Let's set C equal to 1, or actually if you don't want to set C equal to 1, just have energy there. Okay? So this tells me that I think I'm missing something here. No, but that's what it is. That's what it is. So this gives me a relationship between the angular frequency, which is right. So the angular frequency of the rotation and the momentum of the particle. So it says omega p is eb divided by cosine of theta. So the other thing that's interesting is, so if this happens this slowly, then there's this idea of adiabatic invariance. So does anybody know what adiabatic invariance is? Right, that's true. So in this case, what would be the right quantity to talk about? So if I say magnetic field changes slowly, so this has something to do with the action variable. Does anybody remember what the action variable was?
So it would be the conjugative variable to the magnetic field.
Well, no, magnetic field is not a dynamical variable here. So it's really conjugate to some angle, right? Good. Yes, I think it can actually, that would be certain one. Yeah, so in this case, that would be the angular momentum. Because if you have an angle, if you're going around this direction, that's your angle, then angular momentum would be conjugate to that. So that would be, I think that's basically, I think that's basically correct. Although angular momentum is not conserved here, is it?
No, because it's being.
Well, if it wasn't conserved, then it would just spiral out. Right.
Right. So angular momentum, because there is a force. No, it is conserved because you're right. No, actually, it's true. So because the force is only. At least if it's going on a circle, the force would be just centrifugal, so the angular momentum would be conserved. Suppose if it wasn't going on a circular orbit, then it wouldn't be angular momentum. So either invariance is just the action variable is conserved, and indeed, in this case, it would be angular momentum. So that you could define an adiabatic adiabat or action variable, which is integral of pdq. And this is what we define as action before, and this is conserved. So in this case, this is that here you don't care about the motion in this direction; it's just motion in this in the plane, which is perpendicular. So this is just p perpendicular times two pi r. R is the radius, and the idea is that this must be conserved. So the reason this must be conserved, I don't think we talked about it. I think maybe at some point I mentioned it early on in the course. But these action variables, if you change the system as slowly, they should remain conserved. And the reason for that is, it's something that you can prove, basically. So this is something we saw before. Remember, J dot is dH by d theta. To zero order, of course, this is constant. This was because this is conjugate to theta variables. To zero order is zero, but then to first order, if you want to calculate it, everything is periodic in theta, right? So this would be, if you want to expand it to zero order is zero, but then it's periodic in theta, so it would be some things that go as, sum over m cosine m theta. I guess plus sine of m theta with m theta with some coefficients, alpha and beta. So if you actually average this, this would be zero as well, right? Because these are periodic. So it's only the non-zero to second order in perturbation theory. So that's what's important about what's significant about these action variables is that if you change the system slowly, of course, to zero order, they don't change. That's the conservation law. I mean, energy, that's true for energy too. But even to first order, they don't change. That's not true for energy. If you change the system slowly, its energy doesn't necessarily conserve, but its action variables are conserved. And that has to do with basically this structure, that because they are canonically conjugate to some angles and everything is periodic in those angles, if you average this, the first order is vanished. So J dot, even to first order in perturbations, this is zero. If you average it, it's zero, basically, that means. I mean, it does change periodically, but on average, it doesn't change. It would be to second order that there would be some effect in this. So, right. So this, you can calculate this then. So P perpendicular is, right, so this we got as well. So this is just says p cosine of theta times 2 pi r equals, this is constant. Okay. Right, am I missing something? No. And okay, so what else do I need? Right. Okay, so the other thing is the total momentum is constant. And that has to do with the fact that the magnetic field doesn't exert force, right? Because E squared, we know, is P squared plus M squared. dE by dt times E. This is just p dot dp by dt, or p dot, well, but p dot is v cross b, right? So v is along the direction of momentum, p v cross b is perpendicular to it, so this is always zero. So p is constant. But then, right, so I guess I need, oh, okay, good, now I see what I'm missing. So I have two, P is constant. R cosine of theta is constant as the magnetic field changes, and omega P cosine of theta is proportional to the magnetic field. Right? Of course, the other thing is omega times R is C. Right? Because that's velocity, and velocity is approximately the speed of light in this case. So now I can basically find everything, right? If I change the magnetic field, I can find how everything changes. Right, so I can just multiply this equation, these two equations. This gives me omega times R, which is C, times P squared, times cosine of theta squared, is proportional to the magnetic field. But P squared is constant, C is constant, so that says that cosine squared theta is proportional to P. But of course, this should be a number that's less than 1, right? Cosine is always less than 1. So that says that if magnetic field gets big, at some point, then you cannot go to those regions. That's basically the idea of magnetic mirror. That if you have, and of course, you know, since flux is conserved, this is how these look like, right? If magnetic field gets big, but flux is conserved, means that the field lines are getting close together. And the idea, if it gets too big, then at some point, cosine of theta becomes 1, because that's the maximum that it can get. So theta becomes 90 degrees, and then it would be reflected, right? It would come back. Okay? So this is a magnetic mirror. And the idea is that basically, if particles are following magnetic field lines, they don't just follow it in one direction if the magnetic field is changing. And of course, if you have a random magnetic field distribution, its magnitude can increase and decrease. In fact, if it changes by an order of 1, because cosine squared is theta proportional to B, if it changes, say, by a factor of 2, then it could very well be that you need the cosine of theta bigger than 1, so you don't actually get that. It would be. So generically, particles would be trapped within places of large magnetic field. That's called a magnetic bottle. So if you have two places where magnetic field gets big, so like magnetic field lines pinch, this is the B field, then particles will be trapped between these. So they would stop here, turn around, and basically they would go back, going back and forth. So this is not as good as a tokamak. That's why people don't use it, because of course there are some particles that can get through it. If you have a particle with theta equal to 0, it doesn't care about what magnetic field does, it just goes through. So they're always, because of thermal scattering, particles are scattered, so there's a thermal distribution, so there always be some particles that can get through, but a lot of particles would be reflecting off these mirrors. So these magnetic mirrors happen generically, but they're never perfect mirrors. They always have a finite throughput, basically.
Doesn't
a finite reflection.
So do you need the backing of that to be closed?
You don't need it. If you want to make a bottle, you need, it cannot close. Happen is magnetic can get stronger and stronger, but it can never get infinite.
So but what I'm saying is, say it probably gets longer than a few lines, and then it reaches a place where it gets stronger.
Yeah.
And it would bounce back.
Exactly.
But would it then, since it's going against the magnetic field lines, wouldn't it try to reorient itself?
Why would it? I think the direction of magnetic field doesn't really matter. You could be going in this direction. This was this picture. Yeah, so if this is magnetic field, the velocity along the magnetic field doesn't really matter. So you could be going this way around magnetic field, and you could, or you could be going this way along magnetic field. So the velocity in the x direction is completely independent. Just depends on initial condition. Of course, if magnetic field starts changing, then that has an effect. And this is basically the kind of effect that, and that there would be a crosstalk between those two because the total momentum is conserved. So if you take away from momentum in the tangential direction, then you're gonna increase the momentum in the radial, along the magnetic field and vice versa because the total momentum is conserved, or total energy or momentum is conserved. So this is a magnetic bottle, and this is basically, now you can apply this idea that I told you, two mirrors moving together to this, basically to that picture. Now, the thing is that magnetic fields, these are not static configurations. As we discussed in magnetic hydrodynamics, magnetic fields move around with the fluid, with the plasma. We have galactic plasma, it has turbulence, it has motion, basically. So these magnetic fields would be moving, and in some places, these mirrors would be closing together. Some places, of course, it would be other way around. But the places that you make these bottles, then you could get Fermi acceleration. Okay, so that's the idea. And then this acceleration happens until the particle, and there will be, of course, random scatterings that happen in the middle. This keeps happening until the particle comes in with an angle that could escape the bottle. So there would be some time that the acceleration would happen. So there is another way to prove this, which is, I think, kind of interesting. So the idea would be that every time that you have a scattering here, there's a delta E, which would be basically the energy of particle with the times the Doppler shift, which is, so if in one go, you scatter twice, and every time you get a V mirror divided by a speed of light, which is roughly the speed of going back, speed of the particle. So every time you get blue shifted by this amount, if you do it twice, then it's two times that is how much you're blue shifted. Delta E over E is just 2 V mirror divided by the speed of light. So that's basically, that's the formula. So there is another way to do this, derive this simple basic relationship from MHD, which I think is useful. Talk about, so so what am I doing? So we know that E plus V cross B, V mirror cross B is equal to 0. This is just MHD, ideal MHD, right? Because they said in the rest frame of the plasma, a mirror moves with the plasma, right? So the rest frame of the plasma, if you have infinite conductivity, then this should vanish. Otherwise, you get infinite current, right? So that was ideal MHD. So if you're interested in how the energy changes, now, this would be 0 if you don't have any electric field, but of course, if you do have an electric field, we didn't write electric field there, but if magnetic field, in this case, the energy doesn't change, right? Because, if it's completely static, then of course, the mirrors don't move, there's no change of energy, as we discussed, but if the mirrors start moving, that means that the magnetic field is changing. If magnetic field is changing, that means that there's an electric field, right? So P dot dP by dt would be E over C times P dot E plus V cross B. And this is V of the particle. Yeah? So this is 0 for the same reason that we're talking about. But then if the magnetic field actually changes with time, then there is an electric field. So that's unavoidable. And from this, from what we had up here, E is minus B, V mirror cross B, so it's E over C, P dot V mirror cross B. And there is a minus sign here. Okay? Come on. So, and I can plug in the numbers here. So this is just approximately E over C, P perpendicular, V mirror, mirror B sine of alpha. Now alpha is what? It's, I guess it's theta, what I call theta there. So V cross V, just the magnitude of it is V mirror times B times sine of theta, right? Because the only the component that's perpendicular to the magnetic field matters. And then this is normal to magnetic field, so you care about only component of P that's normal to the magnetic field. That's P normal. Right. The other thing that you care about is, that's the question one. The other one is the divergence of B is equal to zero. Right. And this is a little bit, so it's just basically says that the flux across this bottle should be constant. So you could show that from that, I mean, you can just write the differential form for this in cylindrical coordinates that says dB by dz is basically 2b sine of theta divided by radius. But does this one make sense? So where did this come from? Divided by there's a good reason for it, but I cannot see it right now. So I wrote it as if it was obvious, but now I think about it, I don't quite see. Does this make sense? Anyone?
Well, that should be the other part of the gradient.
Should be the other part of gradient, right? So. Right.
It's not changing with R.
So what is the divergence in cylindrical coordinates? It's dB. Yeah, so it's dBz by dz plus 1 over R d by dr of BR, RBR. And then there is, I guess, B phi. So assume it's axis symmetric, so there's no B phi here. Okay, so what is BR? BR is, so this should be equal to zero. So I guess I'm assuming something for BR, which I don't have a good sense for. How did I write it?
Z is the direction of motion, right?
So this term would be this term. So I think this basically, right. So I should somehow get this from 2b sine of theta divided by r. So if you have magnetic field in this direction, if it's getting stronger, the idea is this thing should be shrinking. Normal radius. Okay, so let's do it this way. So you have a particle that's going like this, along magnetic field lines. And so the radius is R, okay? And we know the flux must be conserved. So I see. Is that right? So if the flux is conserved, BZ times area that goes across, is across this surface, should be BZ times area that goes across this surface. Well, or this, these are circles really, right? So, oh gosh, yeah. So let's see. So if I have B, I'm not sure why I have sine theta there. I guess that's the thing that puzzles me. So what I need is B times R squared must be constant, right? Constant. So as a result of this, dB by dz would be minus, would be proportional to, let's say I can take log of this. So it says 1 over b times dB by dz is minus 2 dr by dz, right? And I guess I'm saying that this is dr by dz is is sine of theta divided by r. I'm not 100% sure. I guess I call it alpha, not theta. So there must be some difference between theta and alpha. Yeah.
So what is the angle of the particle? Mm-hmm. Another is the angle. So if we do B mirror from you use the same theta, but...
Yeah, it's... Not the same theta, it seems. Yeah, I think it's, I should call it alpha, really. So I think, yeah, so I think my notes are a little bit confused. So so alpha is this angle.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So dr by dz is just, I mean, is that sine of alpha or is it tangent of alpha? I'm not sure. But if for a small alpha, it doesn't matter. But it's basically roughly that, right? Dr by dz is just the derivative.
Yeah, it's.
I think it's tangent.
Right.
Yeah. So right. I think it might be tangent of alpha, but for a small alpha, it doesn't matter. So anyway, so this is where it comes from. So alpha, yeah, I shouldn't call it theta, it's alpha. Okay. So and somehow apparently this is also alpha. So I guess I should figure out how this thing works. So is this alpha or is this theta here? So what we do is that we look at V mirror cross B. So let's say phi mirror is in this direction. Well, I guess if that's in that direction, and B is along the same, so that would be zero. So you don't want that. Oh, okay. So that makes sense. So you're talking about here, right? So alpha is the angle between B and the velocity of mirror, which is in this direction. Okay. So that's sine of alpha. So that makes sense. So it's not the direction of motion. It's that. It's the angle between the magnetic field, which is magnetic field here, which is kind of a little bit tilted, and the direction of motion. And this is this V mirror is along the magnetic field line. So V mirror in this direction. So that's the alpha. So this is the angle. Not it's not the same as theta. Okay. So these are the two equations we need. And if you just combine them, you get dP squared by dt. Then what you get is ER divided by C, P perpendicular, V mirror. So that was the first term, and the B, what happened to be? I guess I used one of those relationships to get B, right? So omega, remember omega P perpendicular was EB, right? So let's see whether this one makes sense. So what I did here, so I guess it makes sense. I just combined those two equations. So if you plug in from sine of alpha, for sine of alpha from here, put it here, all you do is that you place, instead of sine of alpha times B, you set R times dBy dz divided by 2. So there's R times dBy dz divided by 2. I don't know what I did with my 2. Something happened to 2. Maybe there's a 1/2 here. All right. Now I see. So there is an extra 2 here, right? Because dp squared by dt is 2 p dot dp by dt. And I calculated dp by dt here. So they get an extra 2 that cancels that 1/2. So anyway, so this is right. So this is just combining the flux freezing, the conservation of flux, and the Newton's second law in the relativistic form. Combining those two, then you get this equation, which which somehow is supposed to give you. Something very good. Let's see, what is it? Okay, so this is dp by dt, dp squared. So this is how energy is, how much momentum changes. So the point here is that how much momentum changes depends on how much magnetic field changes. So if you can just integrate this and say delta p squared is integral of this, integral dt of dB by d. Let's say, I'm going to put it dB by dt times dt by dz, or dt by dz, I should say. Let me see. I think maybe it would be a little bit easier to just put it like this. I can multiply this by dz by dt. dt by dz, right? So dp squared by dz would be dp squared by dt times dz dt by dz. Okay? And this is just 1/2 the velocity. So if something is moving the perpendicular direction, this is just 1/2 a parallel direction along the mirror, this is just 1/2 velocity. And this guy is just what I had up there. So so it's ERC P perpendicular divided by V parallel V mirror times dB by dz. So I can integrate this along the z direction. That gives me delta p squared is just, let me just plug in the number. It's just E R P perpendicular divided by C times V mirror times delta B. Okay. And the last thing is, so this is basically the same thing as what we found before. I guess it's somewhere hidden up there. But this is basically, since magnetic field changes, the energy changes. Delta, that's delta P squared. I can, so this ER, I think I can somehow use that, this equation to, yes. So I can use this equation to relate R to P because, what is it? As I said, omega R is V perpendicular, which is V sine theta, or V sine theta, right? So R is just V sine theta divided by V sine theta divided by omega, which is EB times P perpendicular. And V is just the speed of light. So you can just plug here. I get E, C's cancel. There is 1 over B here. I guess these cancel also. So I just get sine of theta. And I get P perpendicular squared. And I get the V mirror. Divided by V parallel. There's delta B here. And I guess V, so that's, V perpendicular is just, V parallel is just C times cosine theta. So if I just combine all of these, well, I'm just take this equation, all it gives me is this delta P squared divided by P perpendicular squared is sine of theta divided by cosine of theta times V mirror divided by speed of light times delta B over B. So if delta B over B changes by order 1, that's the definition of magnetic bottle. This thing is some number of order 1. Then the change in energy is goes as velocity of mirror divided by speed of light.
So this theta is the angle between.
So theta is the same theta I had we had here. It's so.
It's the angle between the normal mirror and the magnetic field line.
Right. So I'm assuming that velocity of mirror is along the magnetic field line. So theta I have it up there. So it's the angle between the velocity and the magnetic field line, right? Okay, so anyway, so this gives the same result that if you, basically the idea is that if magnetic field is changing, then that is an induced electric field, and that induced electric field changes the energy. There was a minus, I don't know what happened with the minus signs. Right, I guess, no, I don't really keep, this is the order, this is true up to the sign, of course. You can define the direction of mirror, velocity of mirror in different ways. So the idea would be that, I mean, of course, I mean, physically, you know what happens, that if you're moving along the direction of mirror, then when you reflect, you're losing energy. But if you're if you're moving in opposite direction, if you hit a mirror that's moving at you, then you're gaining energy. So that has to do with basically, and I guess that's the sine of theta, right? Theta, so it could be positive or negative depending on whether you're moving along the direction or perpendicular to the direction of. Well, I think the right thing is the direction of the motion of mirror, not the magnetic field. Here, I assume they are the same thing. But physically, the direction of magnetic field itself doesn't matter very much. It's the direction of motion of mirror that matters. So I haven't kept track of all the signs properly here. But that's physically what happens. Okay, questions? Great, your puzzle.
Yeah, can't you get infinite changes in momentum?
How?
By just making the angle higher too.
I mean, if your theta becomes close to pi, yeah, 90 degrees, right. So of course, if theta goes 90 degrees, then you're turning around. So what happens is that delta B becomes zero. So,
okay.
Right? So that would be a turnaround.
Okay.
So that would be, right. So if my, let's say magnetic field is getting stronger, so at some point then it goes gets so strong that you're reflected. So basically dB by dz becomes zero, the same place where cosine of theta becomes zero. Okay. So now what to do with this diffusion, or sorry, with this energy gain. So this would be just at one instant, you have this relationship that you get, you gain energy or lose energy depending on this sine of theta, and this magnitude would be basically delta B over V, how much magnetic field changes, and that would change of order one because it's a random vector field. But then this number would be a small because the velocity of mirror, because like what do you think this velocity is? Like for a galactic plasma.
Is it the after order of and the V square root should be after order of the potential?
So what is velocity in galactic?
200
kilometers per second velocity around the galaxy, right? So V over C is like what? What is the V over C?
Small.
Like how much small? Hmm? 10 to the minus.
Three?
10 to the minus 3, right. So that's how long it takes. So basically, the lesson here is that if you want to gain energy of order one, you need to, well, it's going to be a random process, but you get basically every random step would be a 10 to the minus 3. So it could be positive or negative. So you get a basically a random kick in energy every time that B changes by order one. And the size of the kick is 10 to the minus 3. Basically. Your energy changes, the relative energy change is 10 to the minus 3. Because P S squared is of order N is E S squared. Right? So this is just 2 times delta E by E.
I don't understand something. So this is the change of momentum of a charged particle that is trapped.
That's right.
So, why the velocity of the mirror should be the same as the velocity of the galaxy?
Oh, it's not the velocity of the well, what should it be?
Should it be the velocity? I mean, I don't know exactly how the mirror is formed.
Well, mirror is plasma. I mean, what they call mirror here is just plasma. So, this is the velocity is the velocity of plasma.
So the magnetic field's going to change based on like plasma turbulence and like local over densities, right?
Yeah, right.
So then the velocity of the mirror is just going to be related to the velocities of like the turbulent bubbles.
Right, so that's right. So velocity of whatever plasma that
local
these are.
Local over densities, no.
Hmm?
Local over densities don't change.
Okay, so this is a good question. So, if everything is moving together, then you don't expect, I guess, I guess the idea is that everything should depend just on relative velocities. If everything is moving together, there shouldn't be any physical effect. So, is there something we are missing here? Because I haven't here. I mean, I haven't really made any approximation. Except the sine of alpha thing. But so is there some approximation that needs to be made? Yeah, I think this is true independent of, yeah, I think this is true. So the statement is that if you have a plasma that moves and the magnetic field that changes, then there would be a change in energy. This is the derivation of that.
But the mirror is not the tail of the bottle?
No, okay, so I shouldn't really call it, I mean, mirror here specifically is the tail of the bottle when I was talking here. But here, I'm not really talking about reflection. What I call mirror is, I think I shouldn't call it mirror. This is just velocity of the plasma. Because all I'm doing here, I'm just using this equation. And I mean, this is true for ideal MHD. So mirror is built into the plasma, but this is really just the velocity of the plasma. So the point is that this energy gain and loss doesn't happen just at the ends. It happens gradually everywhere because this reflection, I mean, even though like a turnaround might happen at one instant, but the change in energy happens everywhere. It doesn't just happen at one point. And the way it happens is just that if there is a plasma that moves, then there would be an electric field. And if there's an electric field, then there would be work. And this is how you calculate.
Sorry, because the Mirro effect is contained when we use that equation. Like flux conservation.
Right.
That's effect of the mirror.
Exactly.
So there won't be any.
That's right. But this is yeah, exactly. And this is gradual. It happens along the way.
Okay.
That's the point. So whatever the velocity of plasma is, this is how much energy it's how much work is. So if you're talking about something that happens very locally, then like local turbulence, then this presumably should be the velocity of the turbulence, which is probably less than 200 kilometers per second in our galaxy. It's probably over a few kilometers per second. But then if you're talking about larger scale effects, and I mean, you do have a corona of our galaxy that could have larger velocities, then you could get very large velocities there. So this velocity has a range, and at every point, this effect happens. So the largest velocities would have the largest effects in principle.
So to get the really crazy energies, like the 2.1, you have to have, well, would you have to get like a particle going from like the center of the galaxy all the way to the outside of the halo?
But the good thing is that they propagate with the speed of light, so that happens quickly. So that takes only, like, how long does it take for a particle with speed of light to get from center of galaxy to
10,000 years?
So that's quite quick, right? But maybe 30,000 years, right? Because the parsec is 3 light years. But then, so this is a little bit more complicated. I mean, it's not the distance really that matters. It's really the time, because the particles don't really move on a straight line. They follow magnetic field, which is kind of tangled. And the question is that basically, how often does magnetic field change by order one? Every time that happens, then they get a kick in their energy by order V over C, which is say 10^-3 or smaller. So that's the picture here. Every time, so basically the question is, what is the coherence length of magnetic field? So that's the next calculation we're going to do. And I guess that should wrap up. So if I call mu log of energy, so what is shown is that delta log of energy at each kick is something like 2 times V mirror divided by C. But it's a random walk, right? So when you have random walk, you have diffusion equation. So if you have number of particles as a function of mu, dn mu by dt is, you have a diffusion equation, which is d squared of n by d mu squared times average of delta log e squared divided by the time scale for reflection. So this would be the time it takes, basically, for particles to move from one mirror to another, or basically the time scale it takes for B to change by order of one. So this is just a random walk. And you're all familiar with how you can get from random walk to diffusion equation. Now the idea is that at some point particles could escape. So whatever region that you have high magnetic field, of course you cannot, I mean, I suppose you could even escape from the galaxy, right? So that you don't, even in the galaxy, you can eventually, if you scatter enough times, at some point you can get out of it. But even more relevant might be like if you have supernova explosion, places that have very large magnetic fields, those would be the places where this could be more important because the first velocities are bigger and also magnetic field switches more quickly, right? So this happens more often, you get kicks more often. So there is n divided by some time of escape. So this is the rate at which you're losing particles, and this is the rate at which you're scattering energy. This is called second order Fermi acceleration, by the way. It's called second order. So this happens, by second order, it means that at the first order, it's zero, because it could be positive or negative, right? Depending on the velocity of the mirror. The first order that, like, I'm not going to derive it for you, but that's a little bit, in fact, it's a nice calculus, and you could do this, in a sense, more precisely. The first order happens at shocks. So what's special about shocks is that you actually have a very, you don't have a random velocity, you have a coherent velocity. So you have some large velocity, V in, and I guess you have V out. So all the particles that go back and forth between these two always get the same amount, they always gain energy basically. They don't never lose energy, particles. So this always has the same sign for the, if you do it around shocks. This is called the first order Fermi acceleration.
How would you get a particle going back and forth across the shock?
But there will be some particles that do this, not all of them. So some particles wouldn't come back, they would always just escape. So that would be the escape part. But basically, if you always have one sign, then instead of dn by d mu squared here, you just put dn by d mu because you always get one sign. So things, so that's kind of, that would be the difference, right? You always increase the energy. So you do, so the effect, it's a first order effect. That's, I mean, it's, so the idea is that this on average is zero, but then, I mean, since energy, is always positive, then on average, the delta log of E is average zero, but delta E is positive to second order, right here. But here, even delta log of E is on average non-zero in the case of first order. So that's the difference, that even if delta log of E is zero, delta E is E times delta log of E. So you can see that, I mean, to second order, you always get always get farther from the center. It's like a random walk thing that you always move move randomly in a random direction, but your distance always increases from a point on average because distance is always positive. Anyway, so that's the story, and you can actually solve this equation. So there's a steady state solution to this equation, which is. When you set this equal to zero, and that's an exponential, right? This is a linear equation. So it's dn squared by d mu squared is like n. So this is like a harmonic oscillator, if you will. So you can solve it. So n, which is e dn by dE, is the number per unit log energy. Is proportional to the e to the minus alpha mu, where alpha, you can just find it, alpha squared times this should be 1 over t escape. So alpha is t reflection divided by t escape, and then delta log e squared, which is roughly c squared, t reflection squared, divided by L squared V mirror divided by C squared. So so what did I do here? I did something with the random walk business. Right, so I think what I did here is I was saying that so this part, so delta log E is just V over C squared, so this is just this. So the other thing I did, I think, yes, I said T escape. If you're doing a random walk in some region, then T escape goes as L squared divided by C squared T reflection squared. So this is something you did for like for this photon. Single power of T reflection, you're right, you're right. So that's right. So it says basically, I mean, this sums from a standard random walk. This is a calculation you did to act for how photons escape from the sun. This is basically that calculation. Eventually, so if you plug in all these numbers, then you get an alpha, which goes as, or alpha inverse, which goes as L divided by L reflection times V mirror divided by C. So L is the size of the system. L reflection is the coherence length, the distance between the two mirrors, basically the distance, the coherence length of magnetic field. So scale of V. And what else? That's it. Did I say something else? Yeah. And I guess I don't have time to discuss this. Maybe we can just briefly mention it tomorrow. So this is how you can get a power law from second order Fermi acceleration. And the idea is that the alpha you see, remember we discussed it for Fermi acceleration, for the observed. But this is how you produce these guys. What happens to these guys along the way is a different story. But at the production, in principle, you get a power law, right? Because e to the minus alpha, mu, remember, is log of e, is e to the minus alpha. So you get a power law with this power. And in principle, now, exactly what this power is depends on the properties of the medium. But roughly, if V over C is 10 to the minus 3, or like another way to put it, if V of C of order 1 and the size of the system is comparable to the coherence length of magnetic field, you get alpha of order 1. In reality, of course, this could be very different. For first order Fermi acceleration, you always get alpha equal to 2. This always gives alpha equal to 2, turns out, for non-relativistic shocks.
That alpha is the index that allows us to decide if their radiation is coming from.
I think it's 1, not 2. Let's see. I think alpha is given by 1. Right, sorry, go ahead.
So this alpha is the index that we decide, that help us decide which type of process is generating the radiation.
Right.
If
so
it's 1, we will say, oh, it's Fermi acceleration.
It's first order Fermi max.
If it's 2,
yeah. But so, I mean, this is the generation, right? And then the question is, what happens to them as they propagate to us? So that's a different. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. Because, I mean, I guess the idea is that these happen at various sites, like this acceleration places where you have large magnetic fields and large velocities, so for example, close to supernova, or maybe close to the center of galaxy. There might be other special places. But then they have to propagate to us, and that adds a complication to this. So you have to, because, so that depends on the propagation of these guys. and so-called diffusion coefficient of magnetic field, or sorry, of diffusion coefficient for cosmic rays, that could also depend on energy, right? So people have models that basically for generation plus propagation has a good name, Galprop. That's what it's called. So it's a software that basically models magnetic field in the galaxy, not the whole magnetic field, but basically the diffusion. It models the generation of cosmic rays. It has some distribution for generation of cosmic rays in the galaxy and some model for its propagation in the galaxy. So you plug that into this model and it tells you how many cosmic rays you're going to see at any point. And of course, but you can, the idea is that we see only cosmic rays where we see it. So we can basically play with these models. Some of these are observationally constrained, like properties of magnetic fields. You see them, well, you have some constraints on them. Some of them you just have to play with until you fit the observations. Does this make sense?
So these cosmic rays are the electrons?
Well, I mean, I guess you could call them, they could be electrons, but usually what we call cosmic rays are ions, like protons or heavier. Yeah, it could be iron, it could be proton, it could be any type of nucleus, basically. Right? Those are usually what... So electrons don't get very energetic. So that thing is for ions, not for electrons. Electrons don't get very energetic because, and you should know that, because of? And so what does that mean? Why don't they get?
Well, I guess because it's easier for them to get kicked around by other stuff.
But that makes it better than they could get more energy. Natasha, you should know. We've been talking about it. We're talking about it this morning. It's because they emit synchrotron, right? So they emit energy. So not as much, because it goes as 1/mass to some power, right? I don't remember the power, but yeah. So all the radiative processes are much more much stronger. Well, for electrons, they cool much faster. Yeah. And right, so electrons don't get very, very energetic usually, but then ions can get much more energetic. So did we get anything else? I think we covered well. I mean, I guess I'm still missing a lecture. It seems that I think we covered what I had to say about almost everything I had to say about Fermi acceleration. But there is this issue about the thing is, yeah. So it's hard to actually explain what's happening up here, very high energies, because what happens at these energies is that the Larmor radius becomes like comparable to the size of the galaxy, right? And then I mean, then you cannot, the Fermi acceleration doesn't work anymore because of course things can escape, right?
So if you're also reaching like, I don't know, the limits of particle physics.
Well, no, it's not quite there yet, because so 10 to the 20 electron volt is 10 to, well, so the thing is, so 10 to the 20,
well,
one electron.
That's what you measure when they hit us, right?
So that's the lap frame. So that, right, so that's the energy of the particle in our frame.
Yeah.
And 10 to the 21 electron volt is like 10 to minus 9 is 10 to 12 GeV. So that's a lot, that's a large energy. It's still much less than Planck energy, right? Planck energy is 10 to the 18 GeV. It's much bigger than the one energy in LHC, which is TeV, or just 1,000. But the point is that for interactions, this, you have to go to the rest frame, sorry, the center of mass frame. In the center of mass frame, this is not very big, because if you have, if you go to the center of mass frame, well, this is colliding with a proton, for example. Energy of proton is rest is GeV. This is 10 to, what did you say, 10 to 12 GeV. So in fact, in the center of mass is the geometric mean of those. which is, I guess, 12, a square root of 10 to the 12, which is, I guess, 10 to the 6 GeV, which is, I guess, it's quite a bit, still quite a bit high. Right. So it's 10 to the 6 GeV, I think that's, so it's not very far out. But I guess, yeah, that the other thing is that you don't actually see these guys. What you do see is there is showers that you see at the surface of Earth that are many, like, many lower energy parts. So it's a little bit, what's happened here is a little bit uncertain, really. We don't know very well.
So,
and there's a miss, I mean, there are different mysteries. I guess I think particle physics is part of it. I don't think you do kind of push a little bit the limit of particle physics, but I don't think too much. But the other thing is that we don't know how to accelerate things to such high energies because they get, the Larmor readers become perfect to the size of galaxies, and of course these guys then would escape. They wouldn't, you wouldn't be able to Fermi accelerate them. So that's the other part of the mystery. And I guess people think that maybe shocks like around galaxy clusters, very large shocks and cosmological scales could do it through first order Fermi. So I guess we're going, yeah. So I think we're very much over time. I see you guys tomorrow. So, and well.
For photons, we don't have this diffusion part after.
No. Photons don't, they just travel on straight lines. Unless they are inside very dense objects. Like in the sun, for example, like we have that. Right? Okay. Or we did this calculation of companion separation. That's like an example of where something like this happens for photons, right? That you have optically thick environments. Then particles, then you have basically a very similar, you got a very similar equation for photons that connects the terms in that case. But in the galaxy, it's optically thin, so photons just travel on straight lines. Okay.
So, how many orders of magnitude of cooling do you get for those really high energy particles? Like, they're going to be generated at obviously higher energies than that, and they cool by the time they get to us. Or is that not really significant?
Right. So the way that could be an effect, I guess it's called in, well, like a synchrotron radiation, I guess that would be the way. I have a feeling that if it's very energetic, well, actually, I haven't thought of it. Let's see.
Can it be too energetic to emit synchrotron?
There is a. Right. So. Let's see. Shall I look it up? There is certainly a limit. There is some region of the parameter space where you lose. So I can show it to you. Right? There is some region in the space of magnetic field and. Right, size or magnetic field and energy. So, where can I draw it? So, right, so you can calculate synchrotron. Here, yeah, okay, good. So, B versus R, and so for some reason, I have a region. So R is, of course, B and R, this would be related to energy. Because this R is radius of Larmor radius, let's say. Right. So I think I have some formula somewhere that relates this to the energy of particle. This would be related to the energy. And there's an upper limit on magnetic field, so. Yeah, so there is some upper limit, which yeah, I don't have the number here, but there is certainly an upper limit that comes from magnetic field and from the synchrotron emission. And it's, I guess, let's see, for the size of the galaxy, for 10 to the 3 kiloparsec, let's say, this is 10 to the 3 kiloparsec, then the maximum magnetic field is something like, is of order Gauss, a few Gauss. Let's see. So vertex out. So, right, so the point is that, yeah, so if the this is not a very large, I mean, the magnetic field at the galactic scale is like micrograms or something like that. So, why did you say 10 to the kiloparsec? No, I need 1 parsec. 1 kiloparsec. Yeah, 1 kiloparsec, right? Yeah, I think 1 kilo, not 10 to the kiloparsec. This is 1 kiloparsec. So there is a limit, but it's not a very strong limit. So let's put it that way. So the bigger, I mean, in practice, the limit comes from the size of the region. So I have a plot I can show you tomorrow, actually, that shows, it's probably easier than me drawing because it has a lot of lines in it. But yeah, so there is a limit from magnetic field, but it's not the strongest limit. The strongest limit comes from the size of the astrophysical objects that you know can accelerate. Okay, good. Thank you.